Hey, this is Peter Biello, host of The Bookshelf from NHPR. And if you like this podcast, you will also like NHPR's 10-Minute Writers Workshop. In each episode, NHPR's Virginia Prescott speaks with authors about their process, their bad habits, and their best advice for aspiring writers. So even if you are not a writer, it is fascinating to hear how today's notable authors get their work done. Really, really inspiring if you are a writer. Interesting, even if you aren't. So subscribe to the 10-Minute Writers Workshop on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. Okay, onto the bookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Ginny Moon is a 14-year-old girl unlike any other. She's autistic and living with foster parents, and she's overcome with the urge to return to her mother, a recovering drug addict, because she feels the need to care for her baby sister, who is not removed from her mother's care. Ginny Moon is the narrator of the novel bearing her name and the creation of Barrington, New Hampshire novelist Benjamin Ludwig, who joins me now to talk about Ginny Moon. Benjamin, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter.
So you wrote this book from the perspective of a girl with autism, but you occupied the perspective of other characters in the book, the foster parents. Tell us about your experience as a foster parent and how that inspired this novel.
Okay, sure. My wife and I have both always wanted to adopt long before we met. And when we got married that very first year, we became foster parents and then adopted our first placement, a young lady, 12 years old, with autism, who is not Ginny, by the way, at all. Our daughter is so tame and friendly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we were very much immersed in the world of Special Olympics and foster care classes and workshops and seminars for, you know, 3 or 4 years. And that became sort of the background for the book.
Yeah. Ginny is not a one-to-one comparison with the girl you adopted. How did the character of Ginny Moon come together for you?
In a very mysterious sort of way, I like to tell people. If I understood it better, I swear I would explain it better. she came to me through her voice. By sitting at so many Special Olympics basketball practices and listening to the voices of all of these kids with special needs, her voice came together fully intact, fully formed, and once it hit me, it really was all I could do to keep up with it. The book really wrote itself in that sense.
Having her voice is an important mission for you, it seems, because as you write and as you've spoken about in interviews, giving her agency, giving her the ability to advocate for herself was very important to you.
Incredibly so. Kids with special needs and just, you know, kids without special needs, children in general, have an uphill battle, learning how to speak up for themselves, learning how to speak at all sometimes. And I really did want to give a voice to someone who otherwise would have remained largely voiceless.
And boy, is her voice compelling. I mean, from page one, you get a sense of who she is, how she thinks, and what she deeply cares about. And I found it was all completely relatable.
Terrific. What can I say? Yeah, I felt the same way. I mean, I said it's a mysterious process writing from this perspective. I really feel like she's a real person. I've never felt that way writing a book before, and I've written bunches, all unpublished, but still, never have I felt this way about a character. She really seems to be a living person.
You put her in such an emotionally charged situation, right, where she's been removed from this place that was clearly a danger to her, but a place to which she felt really emotionally attached. She was taking care of her baby sister. She had an aunt who was more reliable than her mother. And then suddenly all that changed, and she almost stopped really growing up from that point. And one could understand why she would want to get back to that point, because she had some unresolved business that just needed to be resolved, and nothing was going to stand in her way. It was
right.
Just so compelling.
Yeah, and no one understands that's what she's doing. That's the voice piece of it for me. We hear these kids say things, but we don't really hear what it is they're saying. And Ginny's message is lost by so many adults who work and who work with her and encounter her. And finally, she finds a way to break through all that.
I want to talk about some of the adults, because there were moments here that seemed very honest, especially with respect to the foster parents. I mean, just for a little background in the story, Ginny's foster parents, who she calls her forever mom and her forever father, her forever dad, apparently they couldn't have babies, so they decided to foster Ginny, and then after that they did get pregnant. And they had a new baby. And so the equation changed a little bit. So we see, especially for Forever Mom, Mora, a change in attitude towards Ginny, which made me think, there were several instances that made me think, did this foster parent really know what she was getting into when she decided to be a foster parent? And then that made me think, does anybody know when they
very well said, yeah.
and maybe I should ask, did you know what you were getting into when you decided?
Yeah, we had no idea, and we knew going in that we had no idea because we had so many people telling us, you know, Ben, you have no idea, and they were absolutely right. I like to tell people who are interested in adoption and foster care, you don't do it alone. You need a tremendous network of people, social workers, therapists, school counselors, etc. Family, friends, even neighbors to support you, because you have no idea what you're getting into. It's so much more difficult than having biological children. My wife and I have two children, aside from our adopted daughter, and they're a piece of cake compared to, you know, all of the issues that you deal with taking someone from a different family into your own.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about the foster parents in the book?
Well, the unique situation of the writer is that he has to be every character in the book regardless. So I got to step into Mora's shoes and feel what it was like to feel very protective of my own family. And I also got to step into Brian's and feel what it was like to try to open up some doors and maybe be a little more relaxed. But it was wonderful to be able to step into the different perspectives and viewpoints.
I got to say, I loved Ginny's quirks. I love that she loves Michael Jackson. I love that her sort of curse word of choice is, well, dang. are these things that sort of just you created out of whole cloth or things that sort of you gleaned from seeing and observing the real world?
Well, dang is very much part of Ginny's just natural way of speaking. That is part of her voice. And that I didn't make that up so much as just recorded it when she said it in my head. So I wrote it down. The Michael Jackson thing is really kind of cool because a tremendous number of special needs kids are completely enamored with Michael Jackson. I don't know why, but if you go to a Special Olympics event, I shouldn't speak for everybody, but when I go to a Special Olympics event, oh my goodness, you're going to find some kid listening to Michael Jackson, dancing to Michael Jackson, doing the moves from the videos. A lot of them have the hat and the glove. It's really cool. But they totally connect with Michael. And I love Michael Jackson myself, and our adopted daughter does too, which helps. But it's not just like a Ginny thing. I think it's like a special needs thing that people really dig Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm a fan as well. Maybe that's why I like it so much. But I mean, one of the things I think Ginny said that this he looks kind.
Yes, he does.
He looks like a gentle, kind person. And that's something that Ginny really likes and frankly needs in her life after what she's been through.
You bet. Yeah, Ginny sees pictures of Michael and she's seen videos of him, at least, you know, in the book. And she just connects with him on that human kindness level. Yeah, you're right.
Character-driven stories. It seems like that's what you're all about as a fiction writer.
Yep. Character-driven or voice-driven, more specifically, definitely.
Yeah. So first person is the way you like to go?
Unless there's a really quirky narrator. Unless he's a really unique narrator, and a lot of my current work involves a narrator who is not a character but has a very distinctive way of speaking, and that plays and pings off a lot of the plot points as well.
Mm-hmm. Ginny is an unreliable narrator. She doesn't necessarily know. She didn't put all the pieces together, whereas the reader could. Is that something that you gravitate towards as a writer?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the reasons I write. That's the mystery of it. You think you know where the story's going or where even a chapter's going, and you're writing it, all of a sudden, surprise, it's not going there. There's something better. Writing a book or even a short story, if it's something you care about deeply and really love, is a process of constantly unfolding new layers and new corners and new directions. So it's an adventure.
I want to talk a little bit about your writing process. you went to school, you got an MFA, and you're also a teacher. One of your teachers, you wrote in the afterword of this book, you know where I'm going with this.
I do.
John Yount at UNH.
Yeah, John Yount.
John Yount, excuse me. He said, wait tables if you have to, but do not teach. You did not follow that advice. I think the assumption, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that teaching takes up so much time and energy that at the end of the day, you're just going to have nothing left for your creative writing. Is that the assumption that is underneath that kind of comment?
That, and you simply won't have time. Teachers bring papers home, English teachers.
Yeah.
You come home, you maybe eat dinner, maybe not, but you grade papers. You write in, you know, response journals for kids. You email with parents and administrators. It's not a 9-to-5 or even a 7-to-3. You know, that's why they get summers off. they really need them. But yeah, that's exactly what my professor told me, and that was, you know, a good 20 years ago at least. And he knew it would be absolutely devastating, and for a while it was. You know, getting my feet wet as a first, second, third year teacher, there was no time when you're developing your lessons and your pedagogy for the first time. But eventually, you know, you kind of get that under your belt, you get your legs under you, and you find time. So I got up very, very early. In my first few years of teaching in order to get the writing done. And I found that that worked great because I could just pound out words, you know, rubbing my eyes, not really being able to see clearly, and just forget about them when I went to work and then come back the next morning. And to this day, I have this habit of, you know, early in the morning is when I write, and that's when my best work happens. But you have to steal time. You know, you have to steal it from your sleep. You have to steal it from your kids sometimes. You steal it from whatever you have to. Mm-hmm. But it's not easy. I'm very glad I took this year off from teaching in order to support the promotion of the novel and also to work on the book I'm working on now.
So what advice would you have for writers who have to have a job to support themselves?
Well, first, learn how to steal time. Lunch breaks, planning periods if you're a teacher, whatever you have to do, walk, you know, have your phone with you and type little notes if you get ideas or sentences come. And the other thing that I would say is really embrace self-doubt. Getting up early in the morning to write, I know it's not going to be good. And I'm glad that I think, wow, this is garbage, because the next day I'll come back and look at it and fix it. And if I spend a third day maybe even revising that because I'm just doubting that it's any good, well, hey, that's great. And eventually, though, you get to the point where you just can't change it anymore. And that's when I move on personally. So yeah, that self-doubt thing that really bugs a lot of people and can be kind of torturous, it works for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Benjamin Ludwig, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me about Ginny Moon.
Thank you, Peter. Very much appreciate it.
That's Benjamin Ludwig. He's the author of the novel Ginny Moon, which is scheduled to hit bookstore shelves on May 2nd. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Benjamin Ludwig's bookshelf at nhpr.org. And we are always looking for book recommendations from listeners like you. Renee from Kentucook wrote us to recommend New Hampshire poet Deborah Brown's collection, Walking the Dog's Shadow. She writes, Deborah Brown's language is clear and accessible, and there is beautiful music in the sounds and rhymes of her poems. They have great depth, and I find myself returning to this book again and again. She is a wonderful New Hampshire poet. Well, that's Renee's recommendation. What is yours? Send us an email. Our address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at @nhprbookshelf. And if you like this podcast, consider recommending it to your followers and friends on social media using the hashtag Tripod. That's TRYPOD. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.